Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. The first segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Donna Strauss, who'll be telling us a little bit about Fabry disease. So tell me a little bit about the Fabry Association.
Well, the Fabry Association was established in 2003. And there was never a group to advocate for patients in Canada that had rare disease. So actually, the reason I'm involved is on May 10th, 2004, I was with Genzyme Canada trying to figure out how to open a Fabry Association, a Fabry Society. At that point, we didn't have anything, and actually that was the day that my husband died of Fabry disease, which was May 10th, 2004. Since then, I decided, well, that's where I was, and he would want me to push forward, and I have been involved very closely, and right now I'm the acting executive director of the Canadian Fabry Association, and we have advocated for patients across Canada, and we've done a great job. We have treatments now for patients. We fought the government, both federally and provincially, for treatment of Fabry disease, and so we've come a long way since 2004.
So, for those who might not be as familiar with the condition, how does Fabry disease affect a person?
Well, first of all, Fabry disease is a genetic disorder, and it's caused by a defective gene in the body. It affects both male and female. It's X-linked. It builds up a certain substance in your body, which narrows the blood vessels. So if you kind of think of it, you and I don't have Fabry disease, but it kind of works like a little Pac-Man and clears out our vessels. And if they're missing that enzyme, their vessels get clogged with this lipid-type substance, and therefore it causes like the smallest vessels in your body are in your hands and feet, and that's one of the first symptoms of Fabry disease, is they get pain in their hands and feet. But then eventually it affects your kidney, your heart, and your brain.
So, in your time with the association, what's been the greatest success moment you've witnessed?
Well, definitely the greatest success was the day that they decided that they were going to fund enzyme replacement therapy for patients with Fabry disease. And this treatment is about $250,000 per year per patient. However, as a country, we can do this because there are a lot of people in Canada affected with rare disease. When we started, my husband and I didn't know anybody. And now that we've been advocating and getting the word out through our association, there's over 500 Canadians with Fabry disease.
So, If you could send any one message to the community about why the work needs to continue and why this is something we should be aware of, what would you say?
There's so many things. Being aware of yourself, like be your own advocate when you go to the doctor. If something's wrong, push until you get an answer. The problem with Fabry disease is, and any rare disease actually, people get misdiagnosed for years. So, you know, my husband was diagnosed with lupus. He was diagnosed with depression. They get diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, and none of those things are facts. We can't expect our doctors to know everything. But, you know, pushing and being an advocate for yourself is the most important thing that we can do. And education, you know, today we're lucky. We've got the Internet, which doesn't always give right information, but it's a starting point for people to press forward with their physician to get an answer.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
In this segment of our show, we're going to get an update from Ken Pope. So what advice would you offer to a person with a disability who's looking at getting out on their own?
Well, first, I'd congratulate them, because it's a big step for any young person. And of course, you know, everyone wants to have their own independence and have their own circumstance. The first good news is that if they're at home and getting room and board of $896, then they'll start to get $1169, which is, you know, $273 more, because that's the shelter plus supplementary ODSP amount. So that always helps. So now they're getting, you know, $496 as the shelter component of $1169. And often, in order to get the lease, they have to have a co-signer, typically a parent, because on the face of it, a person on ODSP might not financially qualify for the rent. So normally there's a co-signer, or if for example, the parent has passed on and their estate has set up a Hansen trust for the child as a beneficiary, then what happens is the trust wouldn't normally co-sign. But what it would do is it would calculate the difference between the $500 a month that the person receives and the rent, which might be $1,200 a month. And then what it would do normally is it would ante up the $700 difference on an annual basis, or maybe, you know, even every 2 years or 3 years. But $700 times 12 is $8,400. So what they would do is they'd prepay that amount to the property manager, and the property manager would offset the $700 each month until it was all defrayed. But I find property managers are very happy with this kind of deposit.
So what sorts of challenges typically exist for a person trying to take this step financially?
Well, of course, living on your own means that you're supposed to shop and cook and clean and fix and so on. And, of course, often when you're living at home, even though you may well be capable of doing these things, you don't have much experience, because typically your parents, your mom and dad, you know, mom does the cooking, dad fixes things, they drive you around, you know, and, you know, you don't have a lot of experience with these things. And as well, it may be that, you know, physically there may be limitations. There are, of course, people who have independent supported living funding. There's a whole network of supported independent living organizations around the province. They have a head office in Ottawa, and people can get independent supported living funding where they can actually be an employer and hire people to change light bulbs and fix the toilet and all that, the kinds of things that that a person would normally have to do themselves, but perhaps somebody physically can't do it.
So would that interfere in any way with the landlord's responsibility to take care of things such as that?
Well, there's the sort of legal and the practical aspect. There's no doubt that if the bathroom toilet doesn't work, it's the landlord's problem. They should fix it. That's true. But you know, if what you have is simply a plugged toilet, well, what you need is a plunger and somebody to plunge. You know, Now, you might be able to get the property manager to send somebody to do that, possibly. And as far as changing light bulbs, well, I guess technically speaking, you could get the property manager to come in and change light bulbs, but of course, most tenants change it themselves. So if this was something that a normal tenant couldn't do, there was a thing that a normal tenant did, then it's possible to get supported living, independent living funding for this sort of thing. Now, of course, it's like all the other funding. You have to know the ropes and fill in the forms and apply twice and all of that. But it's something that people should be aware of that is potentially possible.
So from the other side of it, getting a landlord, a property manager to come in and actually do these things with their responsibilities, all the things they have to handle as it is, adding one more thing seems just a little impractical if you can hire somebody with this funding.
Yeah, I mean, it's a practical situation. I mean, what do you want to do? Do you want to wait for them to send somebody to fix your toilet? You know? You could do, you know? So it's just a practical thing that you know, everybody has to deal with. And it's just a very interesting transition from living at home. And this transition is an excellent step because, of course, you know, even people who live at home forever with their parents, and often the parents can remain in their own home much longer because their son, who may have some developmental disabilities perhaps, but, you know, he can carry the groceries, he can shovel the walk, he may be able to drive the car. You know, parents can stay in their homes much longer along with their child. And this is often a good thing, except that it's often the case that that child's only real friend is his mother. His father's deceased, his mother's still alive, and then mom passes on. And it's very traumatic. Plus, it's a very abrupt transition because, you know, he can simply no longer stay in the home. Now it's true that, you know, a Henson Trust could own that home and could do what's needed to maintain it and so on. But my experience is that the home is normally bigger and has more maintenance expenses than the child really needs. So there's often a transition at that point.
So when it comes to supported independent living funding, how long-term is that arrangement?
Well, to my experience, it's forever, which is great. Now, there's another small factor, and that is that when the child is living with the parents, and then say the child is over 18, right, they're on ODSB, over 18, living with family, well, if the child qualifies for the disability tax credit, the parents, of course, are providing them with shelter, so that credit is easily transferred and used by the parents, and it reduces their taxes by $1,600 a year. And they can also use the caregiver tax credit, which it's the parents' credit, which reduces their taxes by a further $1,000 a year, which is all good, right? Well, when the child moves out, if the parents are still helping with shelter, such as subsidizing rent, if they're helping with necessities, food, shelter, clothing, to some extent, then the disability credit can continue to be transferred to the parent. We often find that people think, oh, well, I can only use it as long as he lives with me. And now, since 2017, the caregiver credit can also continue to be used. Until 2017, it could only be used if the child was over 18 and lived with you. Well, now, of course, he's made the transition. He's in his own apartment. Well, as of 2017, the live with criteria was removed. So the parent can also still continue to use the caregiver credit on line 307. The line has changed as well. It's line 307. It used to be 315. But both of these credits can stay in place, and that's something that the parents may not be aware of.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this. But if you could,
you're welcome.
Line for a sec, that'd be great. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
CJAM presents a new exhibit in partnership with the Chimchuck Museum Winter. CJAM FM, making waves since 1983, showcases and celebrates CJAM's 35-plus year history with artifacts from the past, photos, and information cataloging our history in the Windsor and Detroit areas. The exhibit is on now and runs until the end of the summer. Admission to the museum is $5.50 for adults and only $4.50 for students. The Chimchuck Museum is located at 401 Riverside Drive West. Check out the rest of the museum, too, and soak up Windsor history. CJAM FM, your voice of the underground.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Donna Strauss and Ken Pope. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Dorothy Davies, who will be telling us a little bit about music therapy. Tell me a little bit about music therapy.
Well, music therapy is the use of music and techniques and the elements of music by accredited music therapists in order to promote, maintain, and restore mental, physical, emotional, and spiritual health.
So, can you tell me about the association you belong to, the work that goes on?
Mm-hmm. So the MCAO, the Music Therapy Association of Ontario, it's a provincial association of the Canadian Association of Music Therapists, which is the national body that helps promote music therapy and supports and advocates for the accredited music therapists in Canada. So the association, it doesn't provide music therapy services, but it provides information for the public about music therapy. And it shares what music therapy is, what it can do, who can provide those music therapy services, and what the association does is we connect the public to music therapists through our website.
So, are there any challenges in informing the public about it?
Yeah, so promoting and advocating for music therapy services, it takes a long time to get the word out there. Music therapy has been around for a number of decades now, and just within maybe the last decade or so, it's really been starting to gain recognition in the community. So that's one of the challenges, is just continuing to advocate for the field and the benefits of the service. Also being able to connect with allied healthcare professionals, collaborating with other professionals, and just being able to share how music therapy can complement goals that other professionals are also working on with their clients. And funding as well. Funding for programs, funding for private services is a challenge.
So, to look at the converse side of things, has there been any one success story in your work that stands out?
Mm-hmm. I think in general, the gradual growth in awareness is a positive thing to note. There has been more community articles coming out within the last couple of years focusing on the success of music therapy with one client or with one facility. There's also been an increase in published research supporting the benefits and impact of music therapy. We can also see in the different programs, the different schools that offer music therapy programs, there's a growth in that field. More students are also wanting to explore music therapy and pursue that career path. In terms of specific examples, there are a lot of encouraging examples from music therapists that you can hear through different conferences where people will present their work. I know that one thing that is encouraging is hearing about the range of populations people are now working with. So music therapy has gained a lot of recognition in long-term care facilities and with the autistic population. But it's also encouraging to hear how more music therapists are working with clients that have neurological disorders. So maybe those who are facing the challenges of stroke or brain injuries, that area is also starting to gain some recognition too.
So what are some of the key benefits when it comes to music therapy?
Mm-hmm. Some of the key benefits is that music therapy has this unique ability to connect with people of all ages and abilities. So So music therapists are actually working with clients across the lifespan. You can see music therapists working with infants and children all the way up to youth, young adults, and then the elderly population as well. And it also has this ability to meet and address so many of the human needs. So it can benefit physical health, cognitive health, verbal and communicative abilities, mental health, behavioral challenges, social abilities, personal development. So it really is able to not only benefit clients across the lifespan, but across so many different health domains. And I think that's one thing that's very unique to music therapy. So. And I think the reason why it also matters is because it's able to connect with some clients who maybe aren't able to respond to any form of therapy. You'll see maybe some clients with dementia or Alzheimer's, for example, how they are in long-term care facilities and maybe they're not responding to many of the stimulation and environment that is around them. But all of a sudden, they are engaged in a musical activity where one of their favorite songs is playing, and then you can just see the response in their eyes and in their body language. There's an instant connection there. So I think that's one of the great things about how music therapy is able to bring that kind of connection.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Kelsey Rose McDonald, who'll be telling us a little bit about her experiences with autism. So tell me a little bit about your experiences with autism.
So having autism, my experience has been a bit of a roller coaster. I've had struggles since I was younger. As I got older, I've been doing better. Through my pageant, I was able to do appearances, and I just did one currently 2 weekends ago, and wasn't one of my best. I got approached by a lady who was asking me questions and asked me to prove my disability and prove like why I'm not working and why I do modeling volunteer. And I walked away and I kind of thought to myself, like, who do I have to prove to, and why do we have to prove to anyone that we have a disability? Like, I just thought to myself, and I'm like, to anybody that doesn't know us, our disabilities are invisible, and people that are close to us, like friends and family, they know that we have a disability because they're around us 24/7. So there's no way that anybody, let alone myself or anyone out there with any disability, we shouldn't have to prove to anybody. They should accept us for who we are, and if they don't, then too bad.
So how do you go about responding when somebody gets like that?
Well, for me, that was my first experience on the weekend, and I just walked away. But next time, I think I'll just say to her, like, hey, look it, my disability is invisible to people that don't know me, and I shouldn't have to keep questioning my disability, let alone answer questions about my disability to somebody that I don't know. I will gladly let you guys know what my disability is and where I struggle, but don't ask me to prove my disability because I'm not going to do that.
So, can you tell me a little bit about how you got diagnosed, how you figured out what your condition was and what it meant to you?
So when I was in grade 3, I was 9 years old, and I was diagnosed with a developmental delay. And then at the age of 18, I was struggling in school. I was rocking back and forth, and my parents thought there was something more than a developmental delay. I was struggling in math and those kind of subjects, so they decided to get me tested again, and that showed up autism. I am on the higher functioning of autism. I'm not on the lower end. So me, I struggle more with just like getting out with crowds, being in front of crowds, photographers, things like that. I wasn't one to go to concerts. I actually had my friend John, who I met, and through him, I've been able to get myself out there and actually do better than what I did at a younger age. So I'm now able to go to concerts. I'm able to be out in crowds. I'm able to function more than I was when I was younger.
So what's been the greatest success moment since you found your voice, so to speak?
So for me, doing a pageant in Toronto was my biggest. I think that actually helped me get out a bit more and actually understand everything. And then I know I struggled through it, but it opened a lot of doors. And now I've been told by many people that I'm inspiring them for them to reach their dreams. I'm actually running my own pageant for kids with disabilities in July 7th in Ontario, so in Kitchener. So I want to be a voice for others. I want people to understand, like, just because you have a disability, that you can do many things. There's so many things out there. We're smart. We have our own ways. We're smart in our own ways. And I just want people to realize that they need to accept us more and stop putting us down and stop calling us the R word, which I hear constantly. And I get tired of it. Like, that R word, don't put that in any vocabulary, because that means nothing. Like, that R word is putting down every single person with a disability, no matter what.
So what message would you send to the community to get them to just show a little respect, a little decency when it comes to people with various disabilities?
I would just say to the community, like, stop looking at us like we're disabled. Like, I have a quote that always says, see the able, not the label. And that is what I've been keeping with me as long as I could have. Like, it's always been, see the able, not the label. And just accept us for who we are and stop looking at us and stop judging us everywhere we go.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yep.
Kelsey raises a very interesting point, folks. It comes down to the right to disclose. The right to disclose, not the obligation to disclose. A person can choose how much they're comfortable sharing about their condition. Many people with disabilities want you to know. They want you to understand. But interrogating them is not the way to go about it. It's a matter of respect. I mean, you wouldn't ask someone to prove they don't have a disability. You wouldn't say, hey, what makes you able-bodied? You wouldn't do that because you simply don't know the circumstances. And it's probably pretty bad etiquette right there. If a person has a disability, they have a disability. It is not a limitation. It is not the sole factor of who and what they are. It is one part of a tapestry that makes them a unique, breathing, thinking individual. The truth of the matter is, a person with a disability has many rights under the law, same that anyone else would have. But beyond all that comes the unspoken right, the unspoken expectation we all have in society. Simple respect and understanding. We're getting better at that, but there's still a lot of clouds of misperception surrounding some things, mental health in particular. We're growing, we're learning how to see through the illusions, but we still have a ways to go in many cases. Just take the time. Have a conversation. Get to know a person. Don't make it a federal case. A person should be taken at just the idea of saying, I have a disability. This is what makes it what it is. And not being asked to prove it over and over. It's simply a matter that, well, it comes from both sides. We must be open to accepting it and open to believing it. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.